welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Among the unsung heroes are the VIPs, volunteers in police service, who assist police in emergencies as well as day-to-day activities. Geraldine Rader was a volunteer and not a paid employee and had every right to join the legions of people evacuating Paradise. Instead, she chose to stay and do whatever was required. Her day sounds like a police log, and in Douglas Keister's book about Paradise, People, Places, and Pieces of Paradise, he includes her story like a police log. Geraldine Rader, welcome.
Thank you.
So, what was your day like on November 8th, 2018?
Well, I got to say it's one of the most scariest days of my life, looking back, hindsight. But the instincts of going into a life-saving measure for a community and my family kicked in. Hindsight, I think I scared the heck out of myself, but I'm grateful to be alive and have been able to serve my community.
So, Doug has your day starting at 7 a.m., and is that when your day started?
Generally, yeah. I had five cats. They all perished in the fire. So, my cat, Missy, her tendency was to wake me up by putting her paw on my cheek in the morning, and that was my natural alarm clock, and she wanted out. So, that was my natural way of waking up.
So your day starts out normally.
Yes, normally. Then I get a call from dispatch or alert from another VIP saying that we need your help on the higher end of town. We have traffic control issues. At that time, I didn't really understand the extent of what was going on, and I put my two cats that generally go outside and stay outside during the day inside, thinking I would be back to my own home. That didn't happen.
So what happened next?
Well, I went up to the higher end of town, Forest Service Road. My friend's backyard was on fire, and he was struggling to hook up his trailer. So I stopped, helped him get his trailer hooked up so he can evacuate. And then I went over off of Rocky to check on my parents. My dad hasn't driven in 4 years. He's 96. He drove my mom out of the fire. What was shocking, when I got to their place on Betty Lane off of Rocky, their vehicle was gone, and my ex-husband's vehicle was also gone. And he had the task in the last 4 years of driving my parents. So just knowing that both of their vehicles weren't there, I knew they weren't home. You know, they were out of the fire. At that time, I proceeded to try to get back to my home, which was below Pearson on Sawmill. And inadvertently, I went around barricades I probably shouldn't have, but I had to know. I had to try to get my animals. Driving down Sawmill, just past Mordell, it was a wall of flames. And I knew at that moment that I probably shouldn't have tried to get to my house. But I knew my animals were gone, and I had to surrender that and get the heck out of there. I turned around and started driving north up Sawmill. To my right, I see Stratton's Market completely engulfed, already a shell. The walls are standing, but it was engulfed. And I looked to my left, and there was a woman sitting on her walker, no socks on, portable oxygen tank, soaking wet from the heat all around us. I said, get in.
Soaking wet because she was perspiring.
Yeah, because it was so hot. I mean, we're all sweating. The heat was just enormous. The heat did damage to my vehicle. The window stripping around my windshield peeled up. Since been repaired. But anyway, her name was Cheryl or Sherry. I've not made any contact with her since. But I was able to, with assistance, get her in the car and get her up to a safe place. I went to a Kmart parking lot, and there I was hopeful because I saw the EMTs. And I said, Cheryl, this woman needs oxygen. They said, we'll be right back. I waited there a few minutes. Obviously, nobody was coming. It was utter chaos. There was propane tanks going off. People were scurrying around. And I realized, remembering back in 08, I've lived in Paradise since 2006. And in 08, we had the fire scare. And I remember that the CMA Church was our shelter in place location. So I said, Cheryl, and I had turned my police radio down because of all the terror, I'll say. And I drove her over to the CMA parking lot where a gentleman came out and he says, can I help you? And we got Cheryl out and I took her to the CMA church and then proceeded to assist with traffic control and evacuation on Neal and Skyway. And this is something I've never seen in my life, but the community came together and residents were in backs of trucks in their wheelchairs, IV poles. It's amazing. Our town pulled together and evacuated the hospital, three nursing homes, and all the care homes without any fatalities. That's amazing.
Let me remind listeners that my guest is Paradise Police volunteer Geraldine Rader, and she is telling us what happened the day of November 8th, 2018.
Yes. And also, I want to put a plug in for the VIPs. Since the fire, we have lost a lot of our residents and a lot of our volunteers, and right now we're actively seeking volunteers for police service in Paradise. So if you're interested in that, I encourage you to give the Paradise Police Department a call or call me.
Well, Doug includes in his book a photograph of you with your cap with the emblem on it and the patch on your arm saying Volunteer Paradise Police. And that was quite a day for you.
Yes. After safely getting to the fire department, I evacuated with the Lieutenant Borgman in front of me in a car and animal control. I had an evacuee in the car. We headed down the Skyway safely and stayed the night in my car. And as we continue to progress, things are getting better. I got to say the most positive thing about the fire, as painful as it's been, I have met some wonderful, wonderful people that Doug being one of them. And I hope that continues. And I also got to meet Bernie Sanders.
Oh, well, you did mention that your mother and father had disappeared, your mother and stepfather, and you say that it wasn't until the next day you found out where they were.
Right. A kind woman, my parents stayed the night in Winco parking lot. The next day, they drove over to IHOP. I told you my dad hadn't driven in 4 years, so he got down the hill with my mom. So a woman in IHOP called me and said, hey, we have your folks here. So I was able to meet up with them the next day and then get them settled into a shelter, which they stayed for several weeks. Now they're in assisted living. Not ideal, but hopeful that we'll be able to rebuild.
This has been Geraldine Rader, a volunteer in the Paradise Police Service. Thank you so much, Geraldine.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Geraldine. Geraldine Rader's role in the campfire is detailed in a new book by writer-photographer Douglas Keister. After a short break, I'll ask journalist and hiker Catherine Reed about must-do scenic hikes around Lake Tahoe. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Catherine Reed has either been living at or visiting Lake Tahoe since she was a child. She is an award-winning journalist who has worked for Lake Tahoe News, San Francisco Chronicle, New York Times, and other publications, either as a reporter, editor, or freelance writer. When she isn't at her computer, she can be found hiking, biking, skiing, or playing tennis. She now has compiled a book of must-do scenic hikes, The Dirt Around Lake Tahoe, which contains a trail for everyone who likes to explore the outdoors. Catherine Reed, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy, for having me.
Now, when a lot of people write a book and they have to hire somebody to do their proofreading and editing, but you could do all this yourself.
Well, partly. I did have someone edit the book. I always say everyone needs an editor. All writers do. And the cover was professionally done, and I also had someone help get it into book form. So there was a collaborative process about it.
You know, I'm really glad you said that, because I don't think a lot of, particularly first-time authors, realize the importance of having an editor. A very experienced writer who said his editor said, "Oh, this has got to go," and kept tossing out things that he thought, "Oh, no, I really wanted to keep that in the book." But it really is important, and I'm glad you made that point of having an editor, even if you are an experienced writer.
Well, we all tend to read something, you know, we sometimes see things that aren't there, or we read over it. So I always think it's important, and it is an overlooked, almost an art form to be a good editor.
Well, your book is a guidebook, Must Do Scenic Hikes. And tell the listeners how you set up your book.
Well, it's divided into geographic categories around the lake. Those of us at the lake considered, you know, the South Shore, North Shore, West Shore, East Shore. And then I also go out into Alpine County, because it's really our neighboring county to the south of the basin, and then out into the Carson Valley, Carson City, Reno areas. So depending on where someone is located or visiting from, they should be able to find a hike for themselves in and around the greater Lake Tahoe area.
And you do say in your introduction that the hikes in your book were originally written for Lake Tahoe News, and this was between 2009 and 2018. And you said that this was the preeminent news source in the Lake Tahoe Basin during this period. And you say that all the stories are written by you, an average athlete, and you revise them a little bit for your book. So you entitled your book, The Dirt Around Lake Tahoe, Must Do Scenic Hikes. And that is, I like that title. How did you come up with that?
Well, that also was a collaborative effort. I wanted it not to just say guidebook, because I feel like this is more than a traditional guidebook. It's written more in a narrative form instead of listing a whole bunch of different facts. And then as being a journalist in the area for so many years, that the Dirt Around Lake Tahoe has a little double entendre, although this is just about hiking.
Well, you also enlisted the aid of people about the same, you say, about the same ability level to rate the hikes on a scale of 1 to 10 based on scenic quality and challenge. And that's the first thing with each section. The first thing you give us is the scenic value, 1 to 10, and the level of challenge. And you say you got other people to rate that.
Right. And I think this is, you know, also adds a little difference to the book that other guidebooks might not have. There, not everyone wants to be climbing a Mount Tlac, which is our iconic mountain on the South Shore. That's an all-day endeavor, and you need to be in really good physical condition. And you know, just hiking at Lake Tahoe for people who are coming from a lower elevation, just being at the lake level at, you know, about 6,200 feet can be a challenge for people. So I wanted people to know what they would be getting into. And then with the scenic quality, you know, Tahoe in itself is just pretty, but there are some places that are prettier than others, and wanted to stress that what they might be seeing, that way they could pick a hike based on the beauty or the challenge or the combination of the two.
My guest is Catherine Reed. She's a journalist who loves the outdoors and specifically the area around Lake Tahoe. And she has written a book, The Dirt Around Lake Tahoe, Must Do Scenic Hikes. And just this morning, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine whose daughter was up at Lake Tahoe hiking, and she told me the elevation where her daughter was phoning from, and she was a little staggered by that elevation. So what can people expect at that elevation? Because those of us who live in the Central Valley are more or less at sea level.
Well, exactly. And you're going from sea level to, you know, a little more than 6,000 feet is a big challenge for people. So it's easy to get winded. I always suggest that people drink a lot of water to stay hydrated. It's going to be a lot cooler here compared to most locations in California, Nevada. And so you might not think you're thirsty. And one of the things about dehydration is that once you feel thirsty, that's almost too late. That's an indication that you're dehydrated. That's an important reason to always be carrying water with you. Take more water than you're expecting. The other thing is that alcohol is going to affect you more at elevation. So you know, if two glasses of wine is your normal, you might want to have one because it will affect you. And then if you're going hiking later, hiking the next day, you're going to be dehydrated. So those are things to think about. And just knowing your athletic ability, and you need to use some common sense. You know, it is a higher elevation. The sun is going to be a factor. It may not seem as hot, but we're, you know, that much closer to the sun. So sunscreen is something that I put on every day, no matter what my activity is. But just some common sense things.
Yeah, you mentioned some things specifically, like take extra clothes. You might not realize it's going to be chilly up there. Food, a first aid kit, and, of course, shoes, proper shoes. These are things that are essential. I think people might realize that when they're packing. But you also say don't expect your cell phone to work in the wilderness. And since I had read this in your book, I was maybe a little surprised that this friend of mine was saying her daughter was able to phone her from where she was up in the mountains. So that, you say, don't expect it, but you can get pockets of connection, no?
Well, you can get pockets, but you don't know if the pocket is going to be there when you need it. So it's one of those hit or miss things. Even right at lake level, there are pockets where they're dead areas, and they're, you know, it's improving every year. But even out in the wilderness, if you're blocked in by a lot of trees and you're relying on an app to get you to where you need to go, or if suddenly you're in an emergency situation, help may not always be available, and you may have to, you know, the buddy system with hiking is always good, so that if you don't have the cell service there, someone could be hiking out or hiking higher to where you can get that reception. And if you're on the top of a mountain, you're probably going to be able to get cell service. That's actually one of the annoying things I've had about hiking to the top of Mount Tulak, is that people are on their phones and it's kind of crazy. But if you're in a more densely wooded area, you may not get that cell service.
My guest is Catherine Reed, and she has collected scenic hikes around Lake Tahoe. Her book is The Dirt Around Lake Tahoe, and she takes her readers on a journey to lots of trails throughout the Lake Tahoe Basin and beyond that. Now, something that I didn't think of, being a dog lover, I would just assume, well, of course my dog can go with me everywhere up there. But you say in your book, no, if dogs are allowed. So that tells me that I can't necessarily take my dog with me on all these hikes.
That is true. And even sometimes when dogs are allowed, it's not always advisable. There's a lot of granite in Lake Tahoe and the surrounding area, and that can be really rough on the pads of their feet. So I have doggy booties for my dog, and while she has them, she doesn't really like to wear them. She finds them to be an annoyance. But they are suggested. You can get them at, you know, a lot of different stores. But the thing about taking dogs, a general good rule of thumb is that they are allowed on Forest Service land. They are usually not allowed in a state park. And almost 99.9% of the time, they should be on a leash.
So you say check that before you take your dog to find out if your dog will be able to go with you. Now, we talked about the fact that you rate these hikes by scenic quality and challenge, the level of challenge. And you also make suggestions as to what time of year to explore these different areas. You give us some historical facts and details about what we might see along the way. And you describe these hikes from one end of the lake to the other and into these surrounding wildernesses around Lake Tahoe. So if somebody says, well, Kay, what is the one hike that I shouldn't miss? Can you answer that?
Well, I would say my favorite hike is the Rubicon Trail, which would be on the South Shore. And I say that because it is always beautiful. It's at lake level. You would go from Emerald Bay, which is one of the most photographed areas in all of Lake Tahoe. And then you hike down, and it's, I jokingly say, well, it is, literally, it is a mile down, but I jokingly say it feels like 5 miles up. But you hike that 1 mile down, you go to the left of Emerald Bay, you go around it, and you end up at D.L. Bliss State Park. And it is just so beautiful because you're always along the water's edge, whether it's the bay or whether it's the lake. It's a hike that you can do in the early season because it's at lake level. So often trails in May around the basin are covered in snow, so you can't do a lot of hiking here in May. But this is one of those hikes, you know, unless it's a crazy snow year like we've had the last year. Usually May is a good time to do it. Tourists aren't quite here yet, and it's kind of a private little locals trail in the early season. And it's just, you get bang for your buck views.
I like the way you describe this trail, too. I might remind listeners, you said this is the Rubicon Trail, and you say the oohs and ahs are endless when they hike this trail. And you say that the Rubicon Trail never gets old. And you mentioned that it connects Emerald Bay State Park to D.L. Bliss State Park. And you say it's all about the scenery. Now, your next sentence, you say, we are still in awe of the endless hues of blue and the depths to which we can see the floor of Lake Tahoe. Now, who is this we, Kay?
Well, I tend to always be hiking with friends. And who the friends are on each hike tend to change. I name a few of them in my different of hikes, and I'm not sure who all was on that hike, unfortunately.
But in other words, you don't make these hikes solo. Friends come along with you.
Absolutely. You know, Tahoe is something to be shared with people. It is just one of those magical places. There was a time where people thought it should have been a national park, but it got too overdeveloped for that to happen. But it's so close to being, you know, it's like a pseudo national park in terms of beauty. And I just, it's one of those things, you know, pictures can't always capture the beauty, but you have it in your mind and your memory. And if you do these things with friends, then you can always go back and talk to them about, oh, remember when we did this and we saw this along the trail? And it's just fun to share.
Well, and I often find if something is really so gripping, I don't even think of pulling out the camera to take the picture because I'm so absorbed in what I'm looking at. Now, and speaking of looking, this Lake Tahoe is beautiful. And you say on this particular day, you say the lake looks inviting, but we don't even want to dip our toes. And people probably realize it, but you knew how cold it is. And those of us in the Central Valley might not realize that.
Well, I think Lake Tahoe is always cold. And unfortunately, it's a dangerous lake because you can, you know, just feel it, put your fingers or toes in it and think, oh, that's not bad. But if you dive into it, it can be literally take your breath away. And that can be where the dangerous part of it is. It doesn't matter how good of a swimmer you are, that cold water can, it's frighteningly cold. And, you know, there's, unfortunately, people die in it every year because they don't respect what it can do. And then we live in a basin here, so it almost creates its own weather. We can have a lot of wind. It's just it's a body of water, like all bodies of water, should be respected. But the temperature of this lake put down is a lot different than the first 3, 4, 5 inches on top of the water.
My guest is Catherine Reed, and she is a journalist. She has had her articles published in Lake Tahoe News, the San Francisco Chronicle, New York Times, and other publications. She has been a reporter, editor, or also a freelance writer. And you do other things besides hiking. Now, biking, is it possible to do any biking? Because skiing, I could see you could do that, but what about people who say, well, I'm really a biker? What do you tell them?
Oh, well, I tell them if you're a mountain biker, this is a phenomenal place to come to. We do have a couple road bike events that go around the lake. One's in June, one's in September. But it really is an oasis for mountain bikers, and they have created more trails throughout the years, they're always working on them, which is great. There's a local organization called TAMBA, the Tahoe Area Mountain Bike Association, and they have really partnered with the U.S. Forest Service to develop trails that are, you know, meet certain standards as far as width and difficulty. Bring your mountain bike, bring those fat tires up here or rent one while you're here. There's the trails are rated for different categories, just kind of like ski slopes have the, you know, green, blue, black for beginner, intermediate, and advanced. There's a trail rating system as well, so people would be able to find something to their ability level.
Well, the photographs on your cover are beautiful. You have a one on the front stones leading into the photograph, and then you also have some photographs on the back that make us want to go up there and to check these out.
Come up.
And you also, with all these different levels, I think anybody, whatever their level, can find something that will capture their attention and imagination, Catherine.
Well, that's my hope.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about the dirt around Lake Tahoe must-do scenic hikes. Thank you, Catherine Reed.
Thank you, Nancy.
Catherine Reed is author of The Dirt Around Lake Tahoe. After a break, retired English professor and author Carol Burr tells us about the role of literature in the 21st century. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Today, I'll be talking to illustrator and retired English professor Carol Burr about language and literature. She served as illustrator for a very popular field guide to the birds of Bidwell Park, and more recently, she collaborated with her ornithologist husband, Roger Lederer, on a book about bird names, because the scientific names of birds can be very entertaining. But I want to ask her, because she was an English teacher, teaching literature, and students don't seem to be as interested in literature as they were some years ago. So, Carol Burr, welcome.
Thank you.
And I wanted to ask you about this because for some years I was an academic advisor to incoming freshmen at a very large university. And the liberal arts were a hard sell.
Yeah, not practical.
Yes, not practical. Mm-hmm. And how do you respond when students say, oh, Professor Burr, I like literature, but I can't major in literature?
Well, if they even say they like it, we're halfway there. If they say, oh, that was my worst subject, which is a lot of what they say, partly because they've had difficulty writing papers. And sometimes they think the literature is too long. And I taught Victorian novels, so that was the constant complaint I had, that I was cruel in a way, that I would ask them to read six novels that were usually over 500 pages. And I, you know, I did start cutting down on it. But I think the thing about thinking about literature and writing is that students tend to come to college without having done very much in that area, and they are concerned about going to college so that they can make a living. And I know my parents were concerned for me, less so because I was female. But certainly, you know, whether I should take a typing class just in case. So it's an ongoing issue. But one of the interesting statistics is how many CEOs come out of the humanities.
So when parents send their student off to college, the parents are playing a role, too, because they're saying, now, look, this is it's getting more expensive all the time.
Absolutely.
You need to be able to earn a living when you get out of college. And you can't be doing that if you're a history major or a literature major. So that's hard enough to convince students that it's worthwhile. And I would like you to repeat what you just said about CEOs.
No, it's true that I think you, in order to really be successful in a business, you have to be able to write, and you also have to be able to read people as well as books. And I think literature is one of the great ways, other than maybe majoring in psychology, but I like think it's more fun to read a story than just to read about, you know, obsessions or something. So I think that if you're looking not just for the entry-level job, but you're actually looking over your lifetime and what kind of work you would find interesting and what would make life worth living, which isn't just 9 to 5, it isn't just making a living. I mean, it's basic. And I tell all my students, especially the women, that they need to earn their own money, not be dependent on someone else. But I think we also, with the economic inequality we have right now, a lot of parents are very anxious for their children. And so the idea of literature might seem like a luxury rather than a necessity.
My guest is retired professor, English professor, Carol Burr. And you did more things on campus than just teach literature. What else did you do?
Although I used literature everywhere I went. But I did, of course, I was very interested in the women's studies. That was what I tried to get started. In fact, did get started with some very good help from colleagues and students to get the women's studies program going, because I love women writers. It's been one of the things that's been a great joy to me from the beginning. And I was just hearing something on NPR about the young woman who kind of got through her being captive in, I think it was Pakistan, by reading Little Women. So it really can be a survival technique. But at any rate, I created the honors program. And my thought there was, again, that we want students to be able to move along at the rate that they are capable of moving, and that included, in my mind anyway, smaller classes and more reading. So, and then my third big commitment was to multicultural and gender studies. And there I thought diversity in literature, diversity in the student body, diversity in the faculty, diversity everywhere was a bonus. It was another thing that enriched our lives.
Well, one thing that literature seems antiquated, if I want to use that word, because it is so low tech. And these days, our educational system is so technologically oriented.
It's true. I mean, if people want to be technical, they can use Kindle. I mean, read a good book. That way you can feel like you're being a techie while you're reading a good book. I happen to like the feel of a book, but I am antiquated myself. But I really think that technology can support literature. But you have to pick and choose. And just the way you do with any kind of reading, you want to make sure you're reading something by someone who's thoughtful and someone who knows how to put a sentence and a paragraph together.
And I agree with you about the feel of a book. I want to be able to write in the margins. I love the smell of it. I love that I can turn back a few pages and say, oh, yeah, that was who that character was.
Exactly.
And proceed.
And I also like to be able to loan a book to a friend.
Yeah.
Or even just give it. It's something that I found very enjoyable. Also, I'm in a book club, and so which I recommend highly to someone who is not, you know, being required to read by someone. And you know, The Book in Common, for example, which I think is one of the lovely additions to Chico State, where you get to talk with other people and then refer to the page, and you say, "Oh, this passage really moved me," or "This really explained the character," or whatever. And so, I think it teaches empathy reading it. Either on Kindle or in a book that you hold in your hand in that way. So,
well, you make the case that there is a place for literature in the 21st century.
I hope so. I think we're going to be, you know, a little bereft without it.
Well, I have to admit also, you're saying that you need to be able, if you're in business, you need to be able to communicate. And I learned that I've spent most of my life teaching, but there was a time when I opened a tennis shop. And when I hired a manager, the two candidates I considered, one had a business degree. He was a very nice young man. One did not. But she wanted to learn French, and she was more oriented toward liberal arts, and I hired the young lady who could communicate.
Absolutely. And I think you also see, I mean, the resume can make a difference. And I know spell check occasionally will lead you astray. So it is better to be able to do your own correction of your own writing and just be able to express yourself in some way that really makes you come alive to a potential employer. I don't see how you can really get past what I consider the entry or maybe the mid-level without being able to write, to be able to analyze. People who are going to be in charge need to be able to use critical thinking, which I think is very much connected to literature, because literature gives us a package that our lives don't give us. They give us chaos. But, you know, stories have beginnings, middle, and end. And so we get a chance to actually back up and think, oh, you know, I can figure this out. And it helps. I think it's helped hugely for me in understanding my students and understanding people in general, because you learn empathy.
My guest is retired Professor Carol Burr, and she taught literature for a number of years at Chico State University. And over these years, kind of what we're saying is there's been a decline in teaching literature. And what do you see as the consequences of this decline in teaching literature?
Well, I struggle a little bit with this because I don't want to be correcting people's grammar. But I find it a little bit painful when I see how newspapers and other public expressions being so poorly written. You know, the one I've been suffering with, and I don't like to name where I found it, but it's not knowing that with the past tense of to lead is L-E-D, not L-E-A-D. And it's little things like that, and you realize that that it's a loss. I mean, I won't fight over semicolons every time, but they do help for clarity. You know, sometimes you'll read a sentence and because of where the semicolon is, you've lost it, or where the semicolon should be, you really have lost the meaning of the sentence. So I am struggling increasingly in understanding what was intended. So I think just for the virtues of clarity.
Well, I once knew a young woman who was eager to write a book. She wanted to write a book. And then as I talked to her, well, she never read. She never read books. Mm-hmm. I thought to myself, I didn't say, I wonder how she thinks she can write if she has never red.
Yes. And I always feel like, you see these little people. That's why I thought the Harry Potter collection was so amazing for the number of young people that started reading because of that series. And that is actually well written. Those books are well written. The word craft is beautiful. So I think even if a child doesn't like school but they keep reading, I think they're going to be okay. The ones I worry about are the ones that really are just, oh, I don't like to read. The ones that, you know, it's sort of like saying I don't like math, and you're thinking that's not going to make you happy either. But it's baseline, to my mind. It's a baseline for educating yourself.
Well, you get younger age group, younger demographic in your classes, or you got that. And you mentioned being in a book club. And I know sometimes when I would get an older student in class, this older student was so eager and really wanted to learn, knew why he or she was at the university, not for job training. They could look elsewhere for that, but really wanted to change their point of view of the world. And I just wondered if you ever had an older student in your classes, or mainly were they, say, 18-year-olds?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the other students used to call them curve busters because they were so eager and so on task that they would raise the bar. And I loved it, of course, because I don't think you can teach literature as a lecture. It has to be a conversation. And I also think older people sometimes come back to school because they've already realized why that they cannot do what they want to do with their lives if they don't come back. And so they've already been suffering out there in the world without having, you know, sometimes a degree is just the way to get through the door. It doesn't get you the job, but it does help. And so I just loved my older students. And, of course, now I don't know what the average age is in our book club, but it's on the older end. The conversation, the exchange of points of view about a book, I love that. It's a little upsetting to my husband, who likes 2 and 2 to be 4 all the time. But, you know, life
well,
really
he's a
isn't.
Scientist.
He is yes. a scientist, yes, yes. And he likes a certain kind of black and white, and I think literature will not give you that, but it also is more true to life because life is not black and white.
Well, I was a little late coming to – now, literature I could more or less understand, read that, but poetry was a big mystery to me. Chemistry, I could say, yeah, 1 and 1 is 2. Those kind of courses were not a problem. But when I got it in poetry – and I saved it till just about ready to graduate as an undergraduate. And I even went to the office of the professor and said, what do you do with a poem? I don't really know how to deal with a poem. And I have to admit, he really wasn't much help.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because we would go to class and he would tell us about the life of the poet and not really tell us, what do you do with this poem? How do you go about understanding and appreciate poetry?
Yes.
In fact, I recently saw a review in The New Yorker of a book entitled Don't Read Poetry. And I read that twice. And in this book, she actually gives her reasons to read poems, and they're in 6 chapters. A chapter on feelings, characters, technique, difficulty, wisdom, and community. The book resists prescriptive judgments, teems with surprising juxtapositions, and evokes the contagious enthusiasm of a cool teacher. This is what The New Yorker has to say about this book called Don't Read Poetry. The author is a poet and critic. Her name is Stephanie Burt. And this is what she says in her book, Don't Read Poetry.
I have a feeling there's a little irony in
here.
Yes.
Less interested in poetry, the myth that poetry is one thing, than in poems. You have this, anyway, being ironic, as you said.
Yes.
But it is eye-catching because...
Well, what she's doing is buying into what I think a lot of people experience, and they're going, what? I mean, because it's so concentrated, and a lot is done with nuance and connections that you have to make that are not spelled out.
And that's the very reason I so enjoyed, I taught a class in poetry to older adults. I mean, older, like they remembered World War II. And this same poem that a younger person would just go, I think, right over their head. And these older people say, yeah, this woman is crying because her husband has come back from war. And he's, anyway, they had such rich interpretations they brought to it.
But I love poetry just because it's, it makes you, it gives you fewer words and more work to do with your own mind in that sense. And it also moves you if or not.
Oh, well, when I was younger, I wouldn't have understood it. And then when I was older, I would cry. Mm-hmm. A sad poem would make me cry.
So, yeah, it still does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Yeah. That's the thing about literature, too, that it it reaches us, a part of ourselves that doesn't frequently get drawn out. So it's done as a meditation rather than with another person, which means that you, if you give yourself the time, you will discover some things about yourself and maybe about someone else or other people that is just extremely precious in that way.
Did you find that if you taught poetry, which I'm guessing
I did,
you
but
did.
I mostly was a fiction person.
Fiction.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, what kind of fiction did students that appeal to students when you taught them fiction?
Short. I did a short story course, and in fact, I bumped into a student that I probably had 40 years ago, and he had really liked this course, and it was a short story course. But mostly I taught novels, and I think always they preferred the ones that were of their own generation. So I tried to do living authors and actually bring them to campus if I could. I ran a Women Writers of Color series where I tried to tie my curriculum to people I could bring to campus. So Gwendolyn Brooks and Joy Harjo, who's now our poet laureate. I'm feeling very wow. Even before she was rich and famous, I had her here. But we just had extraordinary experiences with living authors coming in, and actually having the students sometimes reach out to a living author so that they realize it wasn't just dead people. Because I mean, Victorians are long gone. So
that would have been harder.
It was harder. Yes, yeah.
I
didn't
literature.
Make a lot of friends with that. Yeah.
Well, you have another talent I referred to briefly, and that is as an illustrator.
Mm-hmm.
And you and your husband collaborated on a book, The Birds of Bidwell Park, that was very successful.
Yes.
And then your interest in language coincided with his interest in birds, and you wrote this delightful book on Latin for bird lovers.
Yeah, that was quite a project.
Yeah. In fact, I enjoyed it so much, and I think people will, that I want to give them a chance to hear it again later today.
Well, thank
you. This Latin for bird lovers. But you're also working on a new book.
We are. We're going to do The Trees of Bidwell Park, and I've done about maybe 135 drawings.
So you're going to be illustrating the trees.
Illustrating the trees of Bidwell Park, yes. And so it turned out to be very, very different than drawing birds. So I've been on another high learning curve, which I'm told is going to keep me from having dementia. I'm counting on it. But it's just another thing. And now I go into the park, and we're keying out trees. And it's something I never thought in a million years that I would be doing. And I'm enjoying it.
Well, I think this will be, because I know your Birds of Bidwell Park was a very popular book, and I would think that the trees would be too, because you can't always count on you go to the park and you take your guide, but the chances of seeing any particular bird are pretty slim.
Yes.
But the trees are there.
They're very much there.
And you can look them up, because so many times I'm always like, oh, I wonder what the name of that tree is.
Exactly. Exactly. And it is the same thing, and I say back to the literature, that the more you know about something, the more you get out of it. So if you come to a book and you know a little bit about the period or the culture or, the person's life, then that opens things up. And I feel as though when I started learning about the birds, which was de rigueur being married to an ornithologist, that I just came to love it. Because once I realized what I was looking at, I could name it. And then a lot of other information that flowed out of that. And I'm actually getting pretty good at bird identification and so-so with trees, but I'm coming along. So I now know a hackberry better than I even knew a hackberry existed. So there you go. It's been difficult, and I've gotten better as I've gone along. So I've gone back and read down the earlier drawings as I've figured out what the best techniques are. Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you Professor Burr. And I might make sure that people understand I'm saying B-U-R-R because it does sound
it's
like...
not cold anyway.
So thank you for bringing us this information about literature and why
it's
important.
You want to
keep it, yes.
Yes, let's keep doing this. It makes us better people.
Former Chico News and Review columnist Anthony Peyton Porter has a poem for us today.
This is a kind of a poem, I guess. It has no name. It's from William Shakespeare. And I found it because I'm an old man, and this poem is about that. That time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few, do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold. Bare ruined choirs, where late the sweet bird sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day, as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals all up in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to know that well which thou must leave ere long. I'm Anthony.
I'd also like to thank Paradise Police volunteer Geraldine Rader and hiking enthusiast Catherine Reed, author of The Dirt Around Lake Tahoe.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.